from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The college class was on the modern workplace, and the discussion turned to the role unions play in protecting worker rights. And then the Northwestern University professor leading the class nodded in student King Coulter's direction and said, "Too bad you guys don't have those protections." Coulter's a good student, but he's also the quarterback on the football team, a leader both on and off the field. And it got Coulter thinking. Eventually, he and a majority of his teammates wound up petitioning the National Labor Relations Board for the right to form a union. And this week, the NLRB ruled in their favor. Players should be allowed to unionize. It's a decision that's shaking the foundation of college sports. We'll take it up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The NCAA basketball tournament, March Madness, is one of the great traditions in college sports. It's spectacular entertainment that benefits the schools, the fans, the coaches, the advertisers, the TV networks. But what about the players who make it all possible? Well, they get the lion's share of their college costs covered, and it positions some of them to go on and play professionally. But does that represent a fair exchange for the revenues the schools and the NCAA take in? It's a discussion that is cutting across all of college sports these days. And this week, a regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled that a group of Northwestern University football players should be allowed an additional benefit, the right to unionize. He ruled that players weren't just student athletes, they were employees and as such had the right to form a union. It's a decision that's shaken up the college sports establishment, and it comes at a time that the NCAA faces a variety of other legal challenges over the status of athletes. And that's the discussion we will take up as well today. Joining us, Luke Bonner. He's co-founder of College Athletes Players Association, which brought the case at the NLRB. He's also a former college basketball player at the University of Massachusetts. Luke Bonner, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Larry Scott joins us as well. He's the commissioner of the Pac-12, one of the leading athletic conferences representing colleges, including, of course, Stanford and Cal. Larry Scott, good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
Happy to have you join us, too. Andrew Zimbalist also joins us. He is an economics professor and sports economist at Smith College. His new book is The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. Professor Zimbalist, happy to have you join us, too.
Thank you. Good morning.
And here, too, is Ellen Starowski. She's a professor in sports management at Drexel University. Her books include College Athletes for Hire, The Evolution and Legacy of the NCAA Amateur Myth. Professor Starowski, thanks for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you.
So, Luke Bonner, let's start with the decision that came down this week regarding the Northwestern football players that your association brought. The key to this decision seems to be this determination that football players aren't just students, that they're in fact employees. And that's based on the amount of time they put into it and the sort of employer-employee relationship that happens between coaches and players. Describe what you think was central to your being able to make the winning argument.
Well, I think you just touched upon it right there with the main thing that you're doing for the university is you're there as an athlete and the amount of hours that you're putting in playing your sport. So the 40 plus hours a week that Division I athletes are putting in and receiving a scholarship sort of is establishing you as an employee of that university. And the fact that if you were to discontinue your participation in that sport, you could lose your scholarship. So I think that's sort of like the basis.
And the comeback, of course, to that is, but hold on, Luke Bonner, especially a student at a prestigious, expensive school like Northwestern University is getting a scholarship, not only at a great school, but a scholarship that's worth probably $75,000 a year. What's wrong with that exchange?
Well, you know, The issue with that is that there's billions of dollars, you know, coming into the NCAA and to sort of cap that. I think the biggest issue is on my end is more the having a player voice in terms of how NCAA legislation is determined. So what the NCAA rules are. There's currently no representation from the NCAA athletes.
So in terms of
rules are made,
in terms of what the Northwestern players want and what your association is arguing for, it's not that you think you're not so much pushing for pay as you are certain worker rights in a sense, right? It's sort of being able to have some impact on the work environment.
Yeah, it's more having a say in the rules that govern the players, you know, because the NCAA rules stand to affect these athletes who are participating in the sports, you know, more than anyone else. And currently, the way the system is, the rules are made without any sort of voice from these players, you know.
Andrew Zimbalist, how did you react to the decision? You've not been in favor of athletes getting paid in the past, but what do you make of this? Do you think this is a step in the right direction?
I think it's a very loaded and complicated question, but I'm very pleased with the outcome of the hearing in Chicago. Primarily because I think that it pushes the reform movement in the right direction. I don't think that unionization at the end of the day is the answer. I think what it does or will do is to create stronger market forces in the college athletics marketplace and move college athletics further away from the vision that it has always had, which is to be subordinated to the academic and educational mission. But I do believe that athletes should have the right to unionize. They are primarily athletes and not students for all the reasons that Luke said, and the system is very desperately in need of reform.
And what are the reforms that you think are most needed? Is it that student-athletes can have some impact on, you know, let's practice for 35 hours a week, not 40. Let's make sure that we have some say-so in how those practices are conducted, or we make sure that we have some guarantees if we get injured. What are the sorts of things that you think students ought to have a little more clout in being able to put forward?
Well, some of the stuff that you just mentioned, I wouldn't do 35 hours a week, though. That's a full work week. That's an employee again. I think that what's written in the NCAA code and not enforced is a 20-hour a week limit. And that should include everything that's connected to sports, even non-coaches' practices. I think that there should be a cost of attendance stipend that would be $3,000-$5,000 that would cover the costs above and beyond books and room and board that students incur while they're in school. I think that there should be an academic counseling program that's controlled by the academic departments and not a separate one that's controlled by the athletics department. I think that there should be better health insurance and disability insurance for the players. So I think there's really a very long list, but it's not always just to benefit the players. Some of it should be to promote the educational mission so that there should be better oversight of the admission process. There shouldn't be students admitted into colleges that only have a fourth or fifth grade reading level.
Andrew Zimbalist joining us. He's economics professor and sports economist at Smith College. Larry Scott is joining us as well, the commissioner of the Pac-12. When this decision came down midweek, Commissioner Scott, what did you do? What did you say? What did you say to your colleagues? Because this is something that's sort of stirring up and shaking things up within your profession.
Certainly, yeah. We've been monitoring it very closely. But you know, at bottom, our view is that this is just the wrong prescription for addressing the evolving needs of student-athletes and the evolution of intercollegiate athletics. You know, it's a very dynamic landscape. There's 450,000 student-athletes that participate in intercollegiate athletics. Intercollegiate athletics has evolved over the years. There's currently a reform movement going on. I think there is going to be some significant change addressing some of the things that have already been discussed amongst this panel. But the idea that an employee-employer relationship should get established between student-athletes and their schools, you know, is just flat out the wrong approach.
Why is it the wrong approach? Why is it the wrong approach? If indeed they are putting in the kind of time that both Luke Bonner and other athletes describe, and they do have, and their lives are controlled by a degree, benevolently or not, by their coaches, why is it not the right way to look at that relationship?
Well, they are students first. first and foremost. They can only remain in the school, you know, if they're students and they're participating in all the same activities and requirements that all students have. There are limits on how much they can practice and spend. It's a fair debate as to whether those are the right limits, whether the enforcement is right or not. Oftentimes, you know, student athletes will, you know, train on their own or do more on their own than they can do officially with their teams. But it's not different from some of the time that other students on campus may spend on other areas that they're passionate about, other interests that they've got, other areas of expertise that they have. Are we in favor of evolving some of the support that student athletes get? Absolutely. And we're very close to getting some governance reform that will allow especially the bigger resource conferences to do more to support student athletes. But I think the relationship between students and their universities is where this should take place, not through a union type of relationship.
Ellen Strowski, join in on this point, professor of sports management at Drexel University, particularly on the academic side. You heard Commissioner Scott just make the point that they are students first. And certainly progress has been made in terms of graduation rates. I was looking this morning at the graduation rates for those schools who are participating in the NCAA basketball tournament, and things are better. And yet some schools, Arizona, for example, and Commissioner Scott's conference from the Pac-12, only has a 60% graduation rate of its basketball players. Wisconsin has a 44% rate. It's also now in the Elite Eight, and a 0% graduation rate for its black basketball players. What does that tell you about what needs to be done?
Well, I think that that we need to look at this in terms of what the ruling by Director Orr has helped us understand.
That's the NLRB because, regional director. Yeah, go ahead.
Correct. And, you know, one of the things that he points out in his ruling is that the primary role of these athletes is that of a worker. And I think the proof in that is the fact that when we look at graduation rates for the athletes who are in the revenue-producing sports of football and basketball, we see very low graduation rates. For example, the average for men's basketball is 47%. For football, it's 68%. And when we look at that through a racial lens, we see that African-American athletes are graduating even at lower rates than that. So we really have serious concerns in this regard, and I think that the fact that that we are not fulfilling that educational promise and have not fulfilled it for decades is evidence enough that the emphasis is on the work production of these players and not on their academic achievement. The very fact that they receive scholarships that can be taken away because of lack of athletic performance, and it does not hinge on academic performance, it is the tell in all of this. So I think what we really need to be doing, if we're talking about real change, is we need to be looking very carefully at why the athletes felt that their only alternative was to go to the NLRB. And all of the other athletes who have come forward in the O'Bannon case, the Alston case, the Adrian Arrington case, the Dowdy case, and there are more and more athletes coming forward. And all of these things are indicating that we are not listening to athletes, that their role is that of a worker, and that we need to recognize that.
Luke Bonner, back to you in terms of describing your own academic experience at UMass, where you were a Division I college basketball player. Describe what you felt you got in terms of your own academic experience, what the pressures were like, whether or not you were really allowed to focus on being a student as opposed to an athlete.
Well, I think from my perspective, I think the sort of the unique exposure I've had is that I'm coming from at this from more than just my experience at the University of Massachusetts. I initially went to West Virginia University, experienced life as a Division I basketball player there, made the run to the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament at UMass. You know, we were a perennial NIT team. But also, my brother played Division I basketball at the University of Florida. My sister played at Stanford University and transferred to Boston University. And then a lot of my friends coach college basketball. So, like, I have a pretty broad exposure to this. And I definitely agree that, you know, you're there for your sport first and foremost, and you're scheduling classes to fit that schedule. I know my brother initially entered college wanting to go the pre-med route. He was a valedictorian of his high school in Concord, New Hampshire, a class of 400, 500 kids. And due to the basketball requirements, he shifted his focus for that. Obviously, it worked out for him. He's an NBA player now. But for a vast majority of college basketball players, that's not the end result.
So, Commissioner Scott, what do you think ought be done so that the student part of that student-athlete equation gets a bigger underline?
Yeah. Well, let me start by saying the observation that graduation rates are low in some sports, and so we are therefore employees, is an illogical conclusion, from my perspective and from my vantage point. In our conference, we've got 7,000 student athletes, and at most of our schools, the graduation success rate is comparable with the rest of the student body. For the example, you talked about the Arizona basketball players that you looked up have a graduation rate of 60%. Well, what do you think the graduation rate is of all students at the University of Arizona? 60%. So it's the facts are that student athletes are oftentimes performing on par, if not better, than the rest of the student body. And as has been pointed out, there are also, and this doesn't get enough discussion, there are also many, many student athletes getting the opportunity to go to school that wouldn't have that opportunity otherwise. As many as a quarter of our student athletes in our conference, the Pac-12, are first-generation college students. They're getting the opportunity to go to school if they're on a full scholarship, which all football players are and basketball players. They're graduating debt-free. Receiving an enormous amount of academic support, alumni support, other types of support that other students, frankly, don't get. So it's been when you're in a role like I'm in and you have a chance to interact with student athletes and you see the transformative role that having the chance to play intercollegiate athletics has in a young person's life, these are the types of stories I witness.
Yeah.
Week in, week out.
No, I hear you. I'm as a college sports fan, I know what you're in. I've read those stories, and I don't disagree with those points. I think the question would be not that what you say isn't true, not that student athletes' graduation rates might not be that much different than their fellow students at their university, or that college sports don't offer a real chance. The question is that enough? Shouldn't college athletes, given the particular and unusual demands that are put on them, have some additional ability to make sure that they can still be students, that they do have some impact on the kind of hours that they put in, so forth and so on. It's not that college sports are bad. I don't think anyone would argue that. It's whether or not our current system is giving them enough.
Yeah, so the point is, do we need to improve? The absolute answer is yes. I mean, there is no question about it, and I've been advocating for some time along with fellow commissioners across the country, especially at the high-resource universities that can do more for student-athletes. We want to do more economically. We'd like to do more in terms of academic support. We'd like to do more in the areas of health care coverage. Right now, the NCAA is operated kind of one size fits all. Everyone has to agree if you're going to do everything, and there's a real divide between some of the high resource schools that can do more, want to do more, and those that can't and don't want to. But we are on the precipice of getting an agreement to allow, on a permissive basis, those conferences and schools that can do more to do more. And I think over the next 6 months, you will see a lot of positive movement in that regard, including more rigorous enforcement of the number of hours people can spend, more academic support. Our schools are all about the academic success of students, including student-athletes.
And Andrew Zimbalist, let's speak to that point about what Commissioner Scott is saying, that the conferences that can should, whether that's the Pac-12 or the Big Ten or the ACC or whoever, that when those resources are available, you're going to see change. Is that a good enough answer?
Look, it's a very complicated issue right now within the NCAA. It's going to, in essence, create a fourth division or four divisions overall, where the Big Five conferences will provide cost of attendance, perhaps, and provide some other benefits, and the rest of the system won't. It engenders more inequality. Look, there have been discussions and calls for reform in college sports since the 1890s. There was a big movement in the 1920s. There was another big movement in the 1940s and another one in the 90s. And each time the NCAA tweaks its rules a little bit and modifies the system that provides a little bit of an improvement, but each time it gets overwhelmed by the forces of commercialization. Graduation rates, I don't know about the University of Arizona, but nationally, and by the way, I agree with Commissioner Scott that we shouldn't be talking here about the men's and women's tennis team and the track team in the same breath as we're talking about men's football and men's basketball. They're very, very different animals. But graduation rates for student bodies overall are several percentage points, probably 20 or 30 percentage points higher than they are for football, Division I football athletes and basketball athletes. And again, for African Americans, it's much lower. In terms of providing kids an opportunity who otherwise wouldn't be able to go to college, I think that's disingenuous, frankly. We're talking about admitting, you just cited the statistic, or Ellen did, about a graduation rate for African Americans at Wisconsin on the basketball team of 0%. If you want to help African Americans, if you want to help underprivileged kids, if you want to help low-income kids, you don't go out and give college scholarships to kids who aren't prepared for college and then play games to get them to retain their eligibility. What you do is you go to the neighborhoods where they come from and you find the students who are academically interested and most qualified, most gifted academically, and you give them the scholarships.
Let me hold
you, football players.
Yeah, let me hold you there, because we have to, both Commissioner Scott and Luke Bonner have to leave us at the half hour, and I want to give them each a last chance before we go to our break in just a minute. So just quite briefly, Luke Bonner, what do you hope comes from this ruling? And then Commissioner Scott, what do you hope doesn't come from this ruling? But Luke Bonner first.
I'm just really hoping that this can to lead to more reform and give the players who are driving the industry more of a say in the rules that are in the legislation that's like controlling the NCAA and what they have to, how they have to act and all that stuff. So I think the biggest thing is just creating a bargaining voice for the players to be able to get what they want and be heard.
And briefly, Commissioner Scott, what do you hope doesn't come from this?
Well, we certainly hope this on appeal gets overturned and does not progress. You know, the idea of classifying students as employees of the university is just the wrong answer and the wrong prescription for addressing some very real needs we have to evolve the NCAA and evolve the relationship with the student-athletes. I'm convinced that's going to happen. This is just talking about pay-for-play and unionization is just the wrong way to go about it.
We'll have to leave it there. We'll come back. Commissioner Scott and Luke Bonner, thanks so much for being part of this first part of our program. We'll continue after our break with our continuing discussion with Andrew Zimbalist and Ellen Starewski, and we would love to have you join us as well at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. More on this discussion after this. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the future of college athletics. We're in the middle of the wonderful phenomenon known as March Madness. But what about the players who are out there on the court or on the practice fields who make that sort of entertainment possible? Is it a fair bargain between what they are doing and the kind of reward that they receive? Is an athletic scholarship enough, or should they receive something more? This past week, a regional director at the NLRB ruled that Northwestern University football players had the right to unionize to try to exert more control over their work environment. It's a decision that only applies to Northwestern's football team, perhaps sets a precedent for other private universities. The public universities would be governed by work rules in individual states. We're joined in this conversation by Andrew Zimbalis, economics professor and sports economist at Smith College, and Ellen Strowski, professor in sports management at Drexel University. We'd love to have you join us as well at 866-733-6786. Ellen Strowski, you heard Commissioner Scott make the argument before the break about that this is just the reforms. Absolutely, they're needed. Conferences that can do more will and should do more. But unionizing or paying athletes is simply not the right way to go. What's your prescription? How, if you were empowered to make a significant reform, what would that one reform be?
First of all, I think we do need to look at history and context, because this has been the college sports system has been a system that has been very reluctant to respond to player concerns. If we really look at what's driving the NLRB suit, as well as a number of other suits that are ongoing at the present time, they speak to the fact that the system has not been responsive to the athletes who have been the focal point of a burgeoning college sport entertainment industry that is now of a magnitude of about $6 billion. And that set of rules that governs their lives has been put into place unilaterally without any input from them. And the end result is that in terms of a fair market analysis, athletes in the top college football and men's basketball programs are undervalued to the tune of about $1.5 billion per year. And so I think that the stakes are very, very high in terms of this. And what we also have is we have a hypocritical system that has not been serving athletes well in terms of their educational interests. So if I were to argue for real change, it happened the other day when the NLRB ruled that college football players at Northwestern are workers. I think that's the beginning step. The next step is to have outside advocacy for athletes, because there's been nothing in the history of college sport that indicates that they will respond in a manner that's meaningful without this kind of measure.
Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Lots of people want to weigh in on our conversation and on this debate this morning. David in Napa gets us started. David, go ahead.
Hi. I think the one thing that is, well, I missed part of the conversation earlier, but I think that the biggest point here is endorsement money. I think Adidas, Nike, all of these large companies are now going to be flooding the players with endorsement money. That's really what this boils down to. And that consequently gives a huge advantage to schools in larger markets. Mm. So in order to compensate for that, the NCAA will have to roll out some kind of salary cap type structure, profit sharing structure, to keep the playing field more even. And basically what you will have created is another professional league for basketball and football and kind of this lower age bracket.
Yeah, David,
it has nothing to do with academics.
Thanks for raising this point. Andrew Zimbalis, why don't you respond, if you will? This is sort of the slippery slope argument that, and I know you're an opponent, actually, of student athletes getting actually paid, but you can see where David's going with this. If you start down this road, then it could easily wind up with a sort of separate class system where athletes at big schools with lots of resources get Adidas shoe deals, and you know the women's athlete at Smith College doesn't.
So first of all, the O'Bannon suit hasn't been resolved. We don't know if they're going to be able to get endorsement money or not.
Briefly describe it, if you would, because we haven't gone through the O'Bannon one. This is the video likeness question. But if you would, just give us a quick snapshot of that question.
So individuals have publicity rights, and if somebody else exploits your publicity rights and makes money off of it that you don't get or that you haven't approved of, then usually that's a violation of the law. And the athletes in the O'Bannon case are saying that the NCAA and schools have made deals with Electronic Arts and other companies for video games, for jerseys, for all sorts of memorabilia that uses athlete likenesses, that uses images, that uses their name sometimes. And they believe that they should be able to get a share of that revenue. I happen to agree with them about that. I'm in favor of amateurism. But I think that the standard understanding of amateurism is not what the NCAA says it is. The NCAA has been changing its definition of amateurism every 10 years since its foundation. The standard definition is you don't get paid for playing either engaging in any job or in this case for playing a sport. If you get paid for companies profiting off of your image and likeness, that's not getting paid for playing the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, the AAU, among others, does allow athletes to get money from endorsements. So I'm in favor of it. If athletes want to sign contracts or groups of athletes want to sign contracts with companies that profit off of their use of their likeness, then I think they should be able to. But that's a separate matter. It's certainly related to the NLRB regional decision, but it's a separate matter from unionization and paying the athletes.
And is your concern about paying the athletes, though, some of what David is getting at with his question, that you set up a sort of class problem that, you know, does the quarterback get more than the offensive lineman? You know what I mean?
Well,
that there's
certainly if you have a labor market, then that would happen. The athletes on the football team at Northwestern say that they're not interested at this point in pursuing wage payments. They're interested in benefits and they're interested in the voice. One of the problems, and we haven't gotten to this, I think it's very important as we discuss that decision. One of the issues is, of course, this is now being appealed in D.C. at the national level, and if it's upheld at the national level, Northwestern could refuse to recognize the union and bring an appeal before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and it could also go to the Supreme Court. So we're still a ways away from having collective bargaining here. But if there is collective bargaining between the football players at Northwestern and Northwestern, presumably that results in better benefits for the football players at Northwestern. Maybe it results in a course cost of attendance stipend of $5,000 or $6,000 and disability insurance and so on and so forth. What then happens in the Big Ten? The other schools in the Big Ten are public schools. They're not private schools. They won't be able to, the collective bargaining rules, the National Labor Relations Act only applies in the private sector, not in the public sector. The Big Ten is going to be very concerned because Northwestern is going to have an enormous recruiting advantage over the other schools.
Yeah.
So the Big Ten then goes to the NCAA and they say, you know, we need to change our rules. Something similar could happen with USC and Stanford, two private schools in the Pac-12. They could enter into collective bargaining with their football players, give them better benefits, and then the Pac-12 starts to pressure for reform in the NCAA. So this case, I think, it's very interesting to sort of play out the different scenarios that could happen. If it's upheld down the line, it certainly shakes up college sports.
Yep.
I do think college sports need to be shaken up.
I have to note, just as a Stanford alum and fan, I'm not altogether unpleased with that prospect, but we'll let it go at that and move on to Arthur, who joins us next in Palo Alto. Arthur, go ahead.
Good morning. I understand that graduate student assistants and graduate student lecturers at certain colleges, which is certainly an academic experience, have been afforded collective bargaining rights. So why is that different from student athletes?
Right. It's a great question, Arthur. Ellen Strosky, there was actually a precedent that went the other way, right, at Brown University. What's the status of that?
Yeah. Well, in that particular ruling, it was determined that the graduate assistants could not collectively bargain. And the argument there was that the graduate assistants, their whole experience was built around their academic experience. And in the NLRB ruling from this week, that case was found not to be relevant to the question at hand. And thus the reason why athletes in this case have been determined to be permitted to form a union. But I think it is a great question because higher education is not unfamiliar with providing opportunities for workers to have a say in their own destiny. And I think what's peculiar to me in these discussions is the notion that somehow we can envision a future where we might have athletes who are primarily working at an institution and who may take classes on the side, for example, you know, for years, even me here at Drexel, I have the opportunity for tuition remission to take courses if I wish. I think if we are really focused on change that will really help the enterprise in a healthy way, I would say that we really need to tear a page from this ruling, take it seriously, and allow athletes to collectively bargain in the top tier teams of or sports of football and men's basketball, which are the primary economic drivers, recognize them as the workers that they are, and move forward to create a new system that will value them appropriately.
Arthur, thanks for the call. We're going to go to Mindy next in San Francisco, who's dealt with this question within her own family. Mindy, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Both of my children played Division I sports. My son played baseball. The summer before his freshman year, he was told by the college coach he needed to play baseball somewhere during the summer. He found a position on a semi-pro team in Ohio. When he returned to college, the NCAA questioned his eligibility because he had played for money needed for college. These scholarships do not cover everything, and we had to really go to bat, no pun intended, to get his eligibility reinstated. I'd just like a comment on these players that need to supplement in the offseason. I'll take my call off here.
Yeah, Mindy, thanks for the call. Andrew Zimbalist, why don't you respond to that? Because this gets to your sort of expanded, your argument for not just having scholarship, but having some extra. And I think you also wanted to follow up on something that Ellen Starowski said, too.
Yeah, so no, I think it's an outrage that the NCAA twists and contorts its definition of amateurism and imposes restrictions that shouldn't be imposed. Jim Thorpe, way back, the great American Indian athlete who was in the Olympics in the 19-teens and won all these Olympic medals in track and field, he had those medals taken away from him because he also played in a semi-professional baseball league and earned a few pennies. I think it's outrageous that the NCAA does that, and it certainly has to change. I just wanted to clarify, with regard to the Brown decision, there was the previous decade, there was an NYU decision that was exactly the opposite around teaching assistants. And I think what that tells us is this is very political. When Clinton is president and there are more Democratic judges around, they make one kind of a decision. And when George W. Bush is president and he appoints other judges, they make a different decision. But in any event, the Brown decision is really about the difference between the relationship between teaching assistants as an activity and being graduate students and pursuing a degree in a particular field, where when you're being a teaching assistant, you are getting training for the same thing that you're going to do when you get your PhD, which is to go on and become a sociology professor or an English or a history professor. It's directly related to that. But when you're playing football, it's not directly related to getting a degree, an undergraduate degree. It's not about education. It's a separate activity. That's what that was premised on. And so it really does have no bearing whatsoever on this case.
Stephen wants to join us next. Stephen, go ahead.
I come at this from a different perspective, having been a television producer and director for a long time and covering sports. I think that primarily with football, collegiate football and basketball athletes, they're feeder leagues to the pro leagues. And I believe that they should be paid. I don't have the wherewithal to determine what that number should be, but I think they should be paid because the universities have incredibly lucrative television contracts. And that's really what this is all about. It's about brands. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Stephen, thank you. What about the we need to keep separate, I think, some of these questions here, because there's a tendency to kind of mush them all together, Alan Strasky, and it's not, they're not either ors necessarily. You can unionize. That doesn't mean you necessarily get paid. Stephen is making the argument that at least, you know, Division I football and basketball players should get paid. Where do you come down on the, let's just focus on that for a moment, on the pay question versus the question of unionization and sort of worker rights?
I really appreciate the caller's question and perspective, because if we look at how we've arrived at this particular moment in time, you know, all of the conference realignments from the past 5 years, for example, have really been chasing the money in terms of television rights. And so I think he's right on point in terms of how lucrative that television market is. In a related way, I also would challenge that we don't already have a pay-for-play system in operation. Number one, you know, if we go back to the 1950s, the college sport leaders at that point in time were well aware of the fact that an athletic scholarship was a form of pay. Number two, the fact that athletic scholarships are given for athletic performance, that by itself indicates that it's compensation for play. So to me, the question is not whether or not athletes should be paid. The question is whether or not what they are being paid currently is fair, and number two, what are the terms and conditions under which they're required to work in order to access that pay. So I think there's plenty of evidence to support the fact that athletes are already paid, but the question is whether or not they're being paid fairly and treated fairly.
But if you are making the argument that they're not getting their fair market value, and I get that, don't you then invite a really complicated kind of equation where, let's say, a star football player, the quarterback, you know, Jameis Winston, who won the Heisman last year at Florida State, gets one thing, and the women's lacrosse player down the hall gets nothing. I mean, how do you balance that sort of possible inequity?
Yeah, I think one way that you begin to do it is you begin to recognize the fact that we don't have one college sports system in place. We actually have multiple college sports systems in place. And what we have is we have for football and men's basketball and arguably women's basketball, a system that is part of the televised entertainment industry, and that's a $6 billion industry. And what we also have is we have what might be called an educational athletic system as well. And I think part of the dramatic distortion that has occurred throughout the system is that that those distinctions have not been acknowledged, and as a result, people get confused in terms of what roles athletes fulfill and how the rules end up impacting different athletes in different ways. And I would argue that if we do continue to go down the path of evolving into a college pro model, hopefully one of the things that will happen is that it will become clearer that what the distinctions are in terms of schools that want to run an athlete education model versus a big-time money-making marketing enterprise.
Where do you come down on that, Andrew Zimbalos? Are you comfortable with having those different models?
No, I don't agree with what Alan is saying at all. Look, if you embrace a bi-sport or a multi-sport model, and you say, okay, we're going to treat football differently and we're going to treat men's basketball differently, then the current underpinnings of college sports, the non-revenue sports and the women's sports, is greatly weakened. And I think as long as we're calling this college sports, as long as we have an umbrella that embraces all of these sports, that provides subsidies for these sports from the universities, from the states, as long as we give them tax privileges, that all the money that gets generated should benefit all of the sports. It shouldn't just go for the players in men's basketball and football. The system we have now is one in which some coaches are getting paid $4, $5, $6, $7, all the way up to $9 million a year, plus very handsome perquisites, while the players are not being paid. The reason the coaches are getting that money is because the players have their pay being suppressed. That's not a fair system. But I don't want to solve that problem by having the players get paid differentially, and then have money that would otherwise go to support the non-revenue sports and women's sports disappear. I think what we need to do is to put the cat back in the bag and control coaches' salaries, give the NCAA an antitrust exemption that's premised upon changing the way the system is organized, and to recreate the system as it was intended to be when it was first developed in the 1850s and 1860s. Beyond that, I do want to endorse something that Ellen said. If you look at the beginning of the NCAA from 1905 all the way up to around 1950, they said that scholarships were pay, and they said scholarships, therefore, are not allowed. You weren't allowed to give a scholarship because that was violating amateurism. Then they decided they changed their minds. So really what the regional NLRB decision is doing is taking the NCAA back to where it was for its first 50 years of existence.
Some comments coming in on our website and by way of email. Alan writes, the NCAA and member colleges make substantial income from television and sales of apparel and other collectibles. Shouldn't the athletes who create the market for that get some form of remuneration? Another listener writes, if they want a union job, they should go get one. They're overprivileged student athletes that have no business forming an athlete labor union. And Richard writes, if colleges and universities were required to provide injury insurance against future earnings for athletes in sports where professional employment is available and elite athletes were permitted to seek outside funding to supplement that insurance, then maybe athletes would stay in school longer and take their classes more seriously. And Mike writes, coaches don't get paid more than professors, right? Well, I don't think so, Mike. Louisville basketball coach Rick Pitino makes $5 million a year and got a $425,000 bonus for winning the NCAA championship. I don't think there are any other Louisville profs who got that. Let's go back to our calls. Steve in Mobile, Alabama, joins us. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, guys. If you're going to talk about paying athletes, I figure we ought to get an SEC person in here because make no bones about it, we're paying our athletes and have been for a number of years. If a kid wants to get paid and he's a 3- or 4-star athlete, primarily in football or basketball, he's getting paid. But part of the problem, other than not having enough paper bags, $100 bills, rubber bands at certain times of the season, is the whole system is particularly, I guess, from football reference. I played SEC ball. My brother did. My father was, and stepfather were both coaches. And one of the issues that has happened over the last couple of years that a lot of the public is generally not aware of is you don't have a lot of advantages that nowadays for student athletes that we had when I was going through. For example, I was a scholarship athlete that played football on the side. You can't do that anymore. My brother was a student athlete, was a walk on, and he had some advantage. But back then, they had athletic dorms. They had tutors, things like this. Nowadays, you have honors colleges. The people that are on academic scholarships have dorms, but the NCAA has decided the students cannot. You don't have training tables. You've got these ridiculous one-year scholarships that some of our coaches down here like to, quote-unquote, process people out 8 or 10 a year. If you have a bad year, you lose your scholarship. And quite frankly, the rules are so cumbersome and ridiculous that I don't know, it's no secret down here, but it may be on the West Coast, that the NCAA just completely quit enforcing it. And the amount of money going to players now is higher than it's ever been that I've ever seen since the SMU days. So the system is completely broken. It's slippery rock. It's not like LSU. It's not like Alabama. And we can't continue to treat them as the same thing and they need to start almost from scratch, redo this entire thing. And I think that it's not, I don't know if the students and athletes can be paid, but they certainly need to get a real cost of attendance. Even though I was an academic scholarship kid, I got $4,000 or $5,000 every semester, and I could live on that. My brother, a football player at LSU, even back then, did not have that same situation.
Yeah, Steve, I'm going to hold you there. As much as it's great to get a voice from the SEC, I've got to move on. But thank you for weighing in and giving us a perspective from Mobile, Alabama. Appreciate it. Greg in Palo Alto is up next. Greg, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Greg. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I've worked in the athletic department here in the Bay Area, and just notice over the past 10, 15 years that traditionally sports have been played on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know, maybe on a Thursday. But because of the, you know, massive amounts of money dumped in for TV, they're now moving Monday, Tuesday games.
Yeah.
And across the country, how are the kids? The kids are now in school maybe 1-2 days a week.
Yeah.
And I was hoping Commissioner Scott was on because he said we're here academically for the athletes. But with the recent Pac-12 networks, it's all out the door.
It's a really interesting point, Greg. And I'm sorry to jump in on you and cut you off so short, but we're out of time. But it's an interesting point about in terms of work rules that if you've got to play on Thursday nights or when basketball games are played, it affects your class schedule and all the rest. Just a quick closing thought from each of you, please. Ellen Starosky, about what you'd like to see going forward.
I think our caller from Mobile reinforces a lot of where I think this needs to go. I think we need to acknowledge what the reality is. We do have a professional enterprise that is operating, and we need to move forward with a system that will a business model that will recognize that and will not undervalue the players in the process. And I think we also have to be clearer about what we're actually talking about.
And let me hold you there.
Whatever decisions. Okay.
Sorry. And Andrew Zibilis, please, just a last word.
So I view the professionalization as a second best option. I think the best option is to recreate real college athletics. And there's a CAP Act out there right now, CAP Act, that's being considered in by members of Congress, and I endorse that.
Andrew Zimbalist and Ellen Starosky, thanks so much for joining us in this really interesting, fascinating, controversial topic. Appreciate it both. Also, heard earlier from Commissioner Larry Scott of the Pac-12 and Luke Bonner of the College Athletes Players Association. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.